It's episode 10 of Riding the Showbiz Way.
It is indeed.
Welcome all to those who have taken the time out to listen. A very, very big thank you. We've had quite an enjoyable time chit-chatting away, and we were wondering what we should talk about today. I think we probably should touch on the BBC.
I think we have to.
Yeah, very briefly. We should also, I think, just review our discussions about AI and how there is a, from my perspective, every day there is a new AI story. And I think one of the things I have learned is not to let any of these things get you down too much, because by the time you've taken a sign with frustration, the next day it's changed.
Well, yeah. A lot of them are just stories.
Yes,
we will see.
You're listening to Riding the Showbiz Wave, episode 10, where we disseminate what's been going on this week in the show business world with me, John Fowler.
And me, Drew Masters.
Ticket prices. And again, the industry, or bands, artists are complaining that nothing has been done. The government, part of the government's manifesto was to take a closer look at secondary pricing. That evidently hasn't happened.
Well, I believe it is in the process of happening, but like all things government, it takes a very, very long time and a lot of money as well. You know, a lot of our taxes go on these things. It's really shocking how much these committees cost, because they go and do a lot of research. They employ people to do that research. It takes time, and then they have to all convene somewhere. Not great use of public money.
It isn't. So can the industry not sort itself out? I think that's pretty, I think it's pretty disappointing, actually, of the industry. And when we talk about the industry, we're talking about the music industry, the music business, or the arts industry in general.
Yeah.
It's anyone who pays a price. And actually, one should include Saka, and because, you know, and ticket pricing for internationals, I would say at rugby, and overpricing. And yet, so riddle me this, they are selling out these stadia on a weekly basis. I mean, if you're an ardent fan, you'll go every week to see your local team. And then in November, you know, you might go every other week for a month to see your international team play.
I mean, at the risk of rattling a few cages, I do think it feels incumbent upon the big major record labels to come down on some of these ticketing companies, because it affects their fans. You know, it seems to me that Sony, Universal have a lot of power, and you have to wonder why they're not coming down on Ticketmaster and the others and saying, look, you know, this pricing isn't fair. Dynamic pricing is an outrage.
Well, I think you're right. And it really just emphasizes that as an industry, those labels, those companies are incredibly powerful, getting more powerful, actually, as every year goes by. In this age, they're dominating the digital space, which is what this ticket pricing is all about. It's a highly complex set of basically hackers, bots, call it what you will. There's not a human anywhere near these ticket purchases. And I think absolutely the heads of companies should get together. Sadly, I know the arrogance of the labels. Well, it's not my aisle. You know, we take care of the actual artists and the making of
records. As far as they're concerned, if there's hundreds of thousands of people queuing up for tickets, that's good news.
Yeah, it is. But I just think there's something ethically.
Yeah, it's morally right.
Yeah, that, you know, and you know, in practical terms, and this is one of the horrific stats that I heard, that for Coachella was 80% of the tickets were bought on credit. And listen, I dare say a lot of the concerts that you went to this summer, that I watched and heard outside the ground this summer, were hundreds of pounds.
Hundreds of pounds, and it was a lot of money. And, you know, as I've said to you before, you know, I take my daughter to K-pop concerts. I take her because she needs a chaperone because she's under 16. And I usually take one of her friends because it's not much fun for her to go with her dad or
that.
And so that's three tickets, you know,
minimum. £150?
Yeah, £150 a ticket, just for the cheap tickets in the not great seats. That's a lot of money.
But to counter this rather sort of cynical and negative story, the really heartwarming moment, I think, of the week is, do you remember we spoke about the Mercury Prize, and eventually Sam Fender won the Mercury Prize and he netted 25 grand. And he is giving that back. He's giving that back to small venues. There must be some kind of consortium. And I thought that was really very, very decent of him.
Yeah.
I must admit, Sam Fender is a guy you get to love very, very, very rapidly. I don't know where and how that will be spent, but just the notion of him doing that to small venues is so important.
Small venues are in crisis, and you know they're not getting any tax breaks, and it's becoming impossible for them to break even. And it's a real shame because all you're left with, if you lose all those grassroots venues, that's what we're talking about all the time.
Yeah,
go and play your local venue.
Go and play your local venue.
If they're not there,
go,
can't do it. And then if you've got is Wembley Stadium, you know, the O2, how are you supposed to get there?
That's right. You know, and I always say this, if there is an open mic, go and grab that mic.
Yeah, let's hope these venues survive.
Yeah.
And if you have any way of supporting them, even by just going,
yeah,
please do. Right, BBC. I mean, let's not go into a deep dive on this. Everyone and their dog has been talking about this week.
Well, it's really interesting. So I have a question, a rhetorical question. Who under the age of 30 cares what the BBC is, even what it stands for? I have to say, I have three daughters. I don't think they ever would have any idea what the BBC is. They know what the iPlayer is, but there's no real recognition or relationship to that being a BBC.
I think that's an interesting point because, you know, you and I grew up with terrestrial TV and the BBC being the pinnacle of that and being an incredibly important public service broadcaster, bringing news that you wouldn't get any other way. And in a digital age, the value of that has been in question for some time.
Certainly with the most recent controversy surrounding a very ham-fisted edit of a speech that didn't really need to be edited. I think, again, with hindsight, we realise nothing needs to be done. And so I put my head in my hands and I think, what were you thinking?
They've made a lot of errors and they keep coming. And this is just one more. And obviously the Trump thing about suing them for $1 billion is just ridiculous posturing.
It is ridiculous posturing, but really this is going to be very interesting what the response is. And actually, I think there are so many legal issues about whether it's he can do that.
The general view I've had from people I've spoken to is show us the financial hardship that you suffered as a direct result of that edit.
And then
we'll look and see if there's a case.
But that's almost immaterial because he doesn't care about that. This is showboating. There was another AI issue that I brought to your attention, which, and as we said, don't panic if you don't think you're up to speed, because no one is up to speed with AI. You cannot possibly be up to speed with the latest news on AI and how it impacts on anyone. But it was quite funny that Matthew McConaughey and Michael Caine had approved, at least as far as I can see, my top line being that they will allow an AI company to reproduce their voices on certain things. Now, I don't know what the remuneration is. I don't know what the commercials are. But when you see things like that, it does rather think, oh, well, it's all good then.
Well,
you
have to think that they will be properly remunerated for that. That's all good. But it does precipitate a race to the bottom, I think, for everyone else, because it sets a precedent that it's okay to do that. Then people go, well, Michael Caine's done it, why wouldn't you do it? And before you know it, no one's making any money.
I'm afraid, well, you took the words out of my mouth. It does create the Wild West, and everyone thinks they can do it. It's very difficult to regulate anything in the media these days. How the hell do you regulate anything? I thought that was interesting. I don't know enough detail to judge whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. But top line of it, you know, what if it's all right for Michael Caine, you know, and especially his voice?
So there were two AI stories this week. One was that an artist called Papi L'Amour was made BBC Introducing's Artist of the Week, Artist of the Month for November. And he revealed in his interview after the song was played that he uses AI to create the songs. And that's caused a lot of consternation on social media.
Okay, so you have the upper hand here. I have no idea what you're talking about, which is absolutely what I've been saying, that nobody's up to speed on AI. Different story every week. Yep. Right, how much of his song is AI? What is AI?
I think it's 100% AI. And
vocally?
Yeah, I believe so. I don't know.
Right.
I don't care, because I also discovered that this is a bit of a non-story, because when I looked it up, I couldn't really find any evidence that he was BBC Introducing's Artist of the Month. I think it may be something that happens in the Midlands on a local radio station. It's really impossible to find any information about it. I think it's a non-story.
Do you mean fake news?
It might be fake news. It might be real news. It's impossible to find out. But anyway, it's not really taking much bandwidth from anyone else.
So I think what's important, and we'll go on and talk about some other stuff, is that if you're young and you're anxious about getting to the next level, don't believe everything you hear.
Yeah.
It really is so important.
Well, so the other story was that an artist called Breaking Rust, I mean, that sounds like an AI made up name for a start, was number one in the Billboard's country charts. Pretty terrifying, with an AI song. Again, it's a bit of a non-story. It's in the iTunes downloads charts. It sold 3,000 copies. So basically, someone somewhere has paid $3,000 to get this to be number one for a very brief amount of time. It's nowhere near the actual Billboard charts that actually are for real music that is being played and listened and consumed by real people. So again, it's a kind of shock tactic to sort of go, you know, I'm number one in the Billboard chart, and suddenly everyone's panicking and going, that AI is taking over the world.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's not. It won't. And whatever you do, don't panic. Have a play around with AI, because it might answer a few queries in terms of your music production that you're trying to do in your bedroom at home. There's nothing wrong with that. But don't panic about it all.
No, and I think AI will become... I think that these big companies like Suno and Udio, if they even exist in a few years, will pivot from offering content generation to everyone to being more tools for real, proper music producers to make their lives easier and quicker. That's fine. I don't have a problem with that. It's no different to using a computer or a sampler or any other technology. I think what we don't want is everyone thinking that they can make music and devaluing the whole industry. But I just don't think that's going to happen.
The frequency and the rapid turnover of this news in terms of AI is really telling you all you need to know, that be very careful and cautious about what you read and hear and what you choose to believe.
Yeah, I mean, I saw an article which is corroborated, and it was on LinkedIn. It was about coding apps. So things like Cursor, where you connect it up to an app like Xcode to write an app for your iPhone. And you just use prompts to create the app and it codes it for you and troubleshoots it. Those apps have been around for a couple of years now. And over the last 6 months, they've seen them go from these huge, huge profits and huge uptick in usage to falling off a cliff. And people are just getting fed up with it. They're trying to build these apps. They're finding that they work for a bit, but when they try and scale them or put them out into the real world and people are using them, they just fall over. And, you know, something changes, they upgrade the iOS in the phone, they have to rewrite it, they don't know where to start. And these apps, they adapt and they will get better at fixing these problems. But, you know, the truth is, not everyone wants to be an app developer. Not everyone should be an app developer. And the people who are best at that are people who are trained and who understand how to build an app from the ground up properly. And they know how to innovate within that space, which is what people want. People want functionality, they want innovation, because they know what's possible.
That's true, but I do think there's an element of the industry, again, the big comms companies regulating this by not allowing these apps on their operating systems. And I think that's sensible. I'm fairly laid back about what I do on my phone, but I very rarely will install an app that looks dodgy or looks a bit, you know, I very rarely do that if I don't recognize the name.
But also, you know, most, I don't know anyone that codes by hand anymore. I mean, everyone uses AI to help them code, because why wouldn't you? It's time saving. But these people are still actually very good at writing code. They could do it by hand. They're choosing not to. It's just like when I write music, I could write it on a piece of paper with a pencil, but why would I when I can just play it into a computer? And if I have a tool where I can just sing the melody and it plays back on a violin, why wouldn't I do that?
But you pay for the privilege of using that app, don't you?
Yeah.
And I think that's so important that us poor unwashed folk who don't create beautiful music like yourself should have to pay. And if we think, oh, well, if I have to pay, then I'm not going to bother. That's a good thing. I really do think, you know, I want to pay a mechanic. He knows what he's doing and pay him decent money rather than somebody who says, no, I'll do it. Just let me borrow your car for a couple of hours and
I'll write your song whilst I'm at it.
And then
and make you an hour. Would you like an act with that? I think we got close to the truth of it in our last conversation where we were talking about the authenticity of artists and the artistry that coming through. You know, when we were talking about how the Sophia James record just didn't do anything much, or the song didn't do anything much for us. But conversely, the Chapel Roan music was instant for me and an immediate. The same with Lola Young, you know, who we've talked about quite a bit on this podcast. I mean, it just comes through. And I don't think you need to do necessarily, I think you could take two artists and they could do the same amount of social media posts and one would be successful and one wouldn't. And it's because of them. It's who they are as an artist. And I don't think it's about how many posts they're doing or anything else. It is simply that they're just really good.
With the utmost respect, and you know when anyone says that, it means they have zero respect for whomever they're speaking to, which of course you will know, and I'm sure it's mutual. We touched on the Group 7 and Sophie, whatever her name is, and I say that with respect to her,
James.
But I spoke to a dozen people about this in the last week, and they literally looked at me like I was speaking to her.
But I think that's my point. My point is that she hasn't gained any traction with an audience. She hasn't connected with an audience where, say, Lola Young, who was doing the same sort of stuff on TikTok, connected because she literally just posted the song. Yeah, but they just loved the song.
Fucking fantastic record. It's a brilliant pop record.
But I mean, that's the thing. But there's something, you know, authentic about it.
And look, what I think we are agreeing on, and we do agree every now and then, is great records are great records for a reason. And the fact that Michael Jackson has a record in the Billboard Top 10, I love it. I was a huge, huge Michael Jackson fan. Mm. I think I touched on that. I was lucky enough to work on one of his tours, albeit managing a support band. And I still think, one of the best gigs I've seen, really, it was at the old Wembley with the Twin Towers. Mm. His finale was, you know, jetpacking out of the stadium. I know. I there's something.
Was he on a wire?
No, it was a jetpack, but it wasn't him, obviously.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, it was he was jetpacked, but he went over the stand and that was it. Whoever was being jetpacked, he just rubbed a matter of feet in.
Did that rule out an encore?
There was no encore.
As you know, I went to see the pre-premiere of Wicked for Good this week, which I was very lucky to get seats for through BAFTA, and they did two screenings before the premiere, which I thought was kind of weird, but amazing. And even more amazing was that there was a Q&A afterwards with some of the crew from the film and Ariana Grande, Cynthia Erivo, and John Woo, the director. It's a brilliant film.
I haven't seen it,
but what a surprise. You know, I mean, it was always going to be brilliant. But actually, what really impressed me was the fact that, you know, Ariana Grande, Cynthia Erivo, they turned up. It was a BAFTA screening, so there were quite a lot of people there. My daughter was sitting next to Sam Mendes. It was a very, very swish. But they came on.
Because you're one of the people, aren't you? You're not privileged at all in any way, shape, or form.
Well, I'm lucky enough to be a member. But to be fair, I just applied to be a member and paid my membership fee. So you do have to be in the industry.
I take that back. That was very, very mean of me. Who was on the other side? Who were you sat next to?
I don't know who she was, but I was sat next to a very nice lady who was there with her family.
And it was Jennifer Lawrence or something like that. No,
it wasn't Jennifer Lawrence. She had been someone very important in the industry.
So I'm delighted that you were able to see it and you enjoyed it. I went to see the first film when it came out, probably a year ago, I guess. Don't know.
Yeah, it was a year ago.
And I wasn't, because I'd seen all the PR. Again, I was kind of obsessed watching the PR all unfold. And it wasn't without its critics, actually. So I did go and see the film, and I thought it was absolutely wonderful. I loved every minute of it for various reasons, but all the right reasons. I thought the whole thing was just blew me away musically. And I thought Ariana and I thought Cynthia were just fantastic. I was genuinely not for six. And so I can't wait to go and see the follow-up. And I'm delighted that all things seem to be telling me that it's a wonderful, wonderful sequel or follow-up. There's some amazing artistry. As much as we are guilty of perhaps being a bit doomy and gloomy about the industry, it's pretty bloody good.
Well, what I thought was amazing, and I think, you know, it's relevant to our podcast, is that they would turn up for a Q&A. And what they were doing was they basically came and did this Q&A at the Cine World, I think it's called, in Leicester Square. And then they literally got up and walked across to the Odeon, where the other screening was finishing, and did it all again. And then they presumably hung around in London for a few days for the premiere.
That's impressive. I mean, I'm
really impressive.
Is it the biggest film of the year, probably? Got to be, right?
I don't know. There's quite a few, but I mean, I think it's, you know, highly anticipated. It's going to be a big buzz off it.
I think in terms of a family film.
And they were great. I noticed a couple of things that really interested me, because when you have those panels, they didn't take any questions from the audience. But normally with those sorts of things, people talk about a lot of the processes or nerdy stuff that maybe people aren't always that interested in. What I noticed was they absolutely only really talked about the story in the film, the characters, their interactions, how the storyline had evolved from the first one. It was very interesting that they didn't really ever veer off into anything techie. There were a few little tiny bits of process, but almost nothing. It definitely wasn't about that. It was all about telling you, I'd literally just seen the film. And yet, for some reason, it made sense. Because actually, going back to our regular thing of, you know, it's all about people.
Mm.
The relationship between the two lead characters is what makes the film amazing. Their chemistry on screen is what makes it amazing, and their incredible ability. And that's what they carried on into the press bit, which is really interested me.
So I'm really pleased about, I think that's a really, really exciting part of this year's output and discussions. And
I could die happy. I've been in a room with Ariana Grande and Cynthia Erivo. I mean, it was a big room. There's a lot of people in there, but I was in the room.
Well, again, that's lovely as well. I think that's, I mean, there are a couple of
there, superstars.
Yeah, and being a superstar is a good thing.
And they work unbelievably hard. They deserve it. That's why they're where they are.
Talking of superstars, and to make a comparison, I wonder if 60, 70 years ago, probably a little bit more, when the films were really, you know, kicking in the 1950s, post-Second World War, the real artists of the time had to sit down on stage and do Q&As. I'm not sure they did.
I don't think they did.
And what's so fascinating is, just to try and give this context, I watched a rather wonderful film this week called Mr. Burton,
mm-hmm.
which is about Richard Jenkins' early years. And it forced me to watch a documentary, the Richard Burton documentary, that I was fascinated. I've been close to and spent time with very, very high-earning individuals, hugely successful individuals, and I've been very blessed and lucky. And I've seen excess, and I've seen a lot of what goes on. And even I was taken aback with Richard Burton's story.
Really?
Yeah. I sat there thinking, gosh, I didn't know that. And of course, the Richard Burton, Liz Taylor story about real stardom, how huge they were.
Mm.
I would urge people to have a little look at that. And I wonder, I can't imagine that Burton would sit down at a movie premiere. He would do the premiere, movie premieres. It's well documented how amazing they were. I don't see him sitting down and answering questions from anyone.
Be interesting to see how much interview footage there is of him.
Very, very sadly, died at 58. And I don't think anyone raises an eyebrow or would be at all surprised.
I think that's considered quite good innings in the 50s.
Well, for what he was doing, goodness me. But no, I think that's rather lovely. And I love the fact that they did these Q&As, and I love the fact that it's going to be a massive success. And that's what we need. This business needs superstars.
It's entertainment. And going back to where we started about funding for things like grassroots venues, you know, with everything that's going on in the world, you really do need some entertainment. You've been listening to Riding the Showbiz Wave. That was the end of episode 10, the last one of season 1. And so we season series, I don't know. Last one of season one, I'm going to be American.
Which suggests, my friend, there may be a season two. I'm going to say series because I'm a good old Brit. In any event, we look forward to hearing from you all and seeing you again soon.